Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another awesome episode of the Biff Bites podcast. I'm your host, Jerry Mee, joined as always by the one, the only, Mr. Adam Scheer. How's it going, Adam?
All right, Jerry. I feel like one of those runners that crosses the line in the marathons, and then they get the silver medal blanket. You know, this is how it is in Biff Crew Zone. After the CFP exam, it actually ends today as we're recording it, right? This is the last day of testing.
Today is the last day of testing on our recording day here. So we are officially on the other side. The March review is in the bag. So congrats to all of the newly minted CFPs out there. And as is tradition, we always kind of like to do a little bit of a fun episode to wrap up the cycle. You know, we haven't really dove into July just quite yet for the July exam. And we figured we'd kind of bring a nice laid back, easy, fun episode for you guys before we get into the nitty gritty of the July cycle.
Yeah, definitely. And as we were talking about possible episode ideas, Jerry and I couldn't help but look to the financial news, and we've been seeing a lot of buzz out there about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, so we felt like this would be a fun thing to talk through.
Yeah, it's coming back into the zeitgeist. I know, Adam, you mentioned your wife, who is not financially inclined, not in the industry or anything like that, brought up Bitcoin to you, and you're like, huh, that's a sign, it's coming on back.
that's the indicator for sure. I mean, don't get me wrong, working from a home office and doing what we do, there's a lot of financial planning talk and language in our house. I just think it might be tuned out.
I forget who it was. It was like either Andrew Carnegie or JP Morgan, like one of those titans of industry back at the turn of the century, said, the reason why he cashed out right before the Great Depression, the stock market crash of the 20s, was because his shoe shine boy was giving him stock tips. And that was his sign that, things might be a little overheated. And we definitely saw that a few years ago with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Bitcoin has had several bubble pops over the years, and it just keeps coming back in. I'll do it again. And Bitcoin is, and cryptocurrency in general, has had a massive resurgence this year. I think it's up over 100% this year alone, or I think that might have been Ethereum, but all the cryptocurrencies have really exploded in value. It's showing up in the financial news again. Articles are coming about, and there's a bunch of different reasons for that we're going to get into today, but it's definitely coming back to the forefront of people's minds, and it makes you wonder, is history going to repeat itself a little bit?
I mean, as kind of a crypto naysayer, I would say yes. but also, I feel like there's just something about these cycles and the record highs. It all just comes back to some of the core behavioral finance stuff, right? Where people want to jump on board, right? I want to jump on board. I want to be a part of the party on the way up. And then you see the behavioral stuff when it goes in the other direction too. People rapidly selling off, right? Following the masses. But Jerry, I continue to come back to just this core thing. How do you explain what this is simply enough so that you can have just your financial planning client with an average understanding, like middle of the ground understanding on the way that the financial markets work and portfolio design works and all that stuff? How do you describe this simply?
Yeah, we'll just do a full just kind of baseline, make sure everyone's on the same page here. And full disclosure, Adam is a crypto naysayer. I do personally have both Bitcoin and Ethereum in my portfolio. I also have done mining on my computer. I've actually mined cryptocurrency, so I am by no means an expert. Don't take that as me saying I know everything going on here, but I will say I do have a little bit of experience in this area.
Far more than me. And I told you before we went live that I don't know much, but I have very strong opinions on this.
So
but tell us, what's this about? How does it work?
At its core, cryptocurrency is really more of a ledger system, a way to keep track of things. You know, it's a decentralized currency, which means it's a form of money that is not tied to any government. You know, like the US dollar is tied to the US government. The British pound is tied to England. You know, typically throughout history, currencies have been tied to sovereign nations which back that currency. Cryptocurrency is something new. It's, you know, on its own, a currency that is agreed upon by the investors in that currency, the holders of that currency. Its value is derived entirely from, you know, the trust that people put into that their money, which in today's day and age, pretty much all currency is. You know, very few nations still have their currencies tied to like a gold standard or anything like that. So in that respect, it's very similar to other currencies out there. The difference is instead of being backed by a sovereign nation, all the owners of the cryptocurrency agree upon where that currency is and where those transactions take place through a ledger, which is basically a massive block. It's called a blockchain. It's a massive block of information detailing the transactions of where that cryptocurrency gets transferred, who holds that cryptocurrency, who they sent it to, who they received it from. And keeping track of that massive amount of information takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of resources. And so, in order to keep track of that, what happens is people can volunteer to be miners. And what they're doing is they're having their very sophisticated computers solve very complex mathematical equations. And if they are the first one to solve that mathematical equation, they get to add the next line item on the ledger detailing, you know, this Bitcoin was transferred to this person for, you know, this amount of money. They are able to add that piece of data to the ledger. Everyone recognizes that, and as a reward, they get awarded a Bitcoin. That is called mining the Bitcoin. You're basically a very sophisticated accountant, you know, adding a line item to this great shared ledger that everyone agrees upon. And as a reward, you get a little magical Bitcoin pops into existence and gets deposited into your account. That is called proof of work. You are doing the work and you are being rewarded but for that work in the form of this currency. And then the way that the currency derives value is people can exchange their US dollars or their euros or their pounds, you know, whatever currency they would like, they can exchange that currency for Bitcoin and then use that Bitcoin as a way to make transactions typically online, because we're starting to see more and more different, you know, online businesses and even in-person businesses accepting Bitcoin as a form of currency. And people who typically are less trustful of the government are very inclined to gravitate towards Bitcoin because it is this decentralized currency. It is not beholden to the wishes of, you know, say the Federal Reserve pumping out a whole bunch of money over the last few years, causing inflation to skyrocket. So you don't have to worry about things like that happening with Bitcoin. So people who are distrustful, or maybe not even just distrustful, just unhappy, say, with the course of action that maybe the Federal Reserve and Congress has been taking over the last couple of years with managing the money supply, they are attracted to Bitcoin as an alternative for them to put their money into without having to worry about it being eroded due to inflation.
All right, got it. So that clears up some of the questions that have been out there. I still come back to, like, let's say you're across the table from a client, and how does even the due diligence on something like that happen, right? How can you say this is something you're going to want in your portfolio? Because just in tracking this over the last 5 years, right, where it's really exploded and come to the forefront in society, and it just seems like there have been all of these different takes on what it is and how it functions, and it just doesn't seem to ever like really rise to like, okay, this is what this represents in the context of a portfolio. You know, way back when we were at peak inflation, pandemic years, right? It's it, the people are saying, well, this is an inflation hedge. Like, this is great for inflation. And then it wasn't. So it was an inflation hedge until it wasn't.
Well,
And
it's kind of like inflation hedge the way that like futures contracts are an inflation hedge. You know, I could buy a whole bunch of, you know, hog belly future contracts and corn future contracts, and you know, those would do great during inflation because they're a commodity and they gain in value, but they're also extremely volatile. So yes, it is a good hedge against inflation because it's a quote unquote commodity, or at least it operates in a similar fashion to a commodity. But with that also comes a huge amount of volatility, which could cause you to lose money. You're not losing money because of inflation. You're losing money just because of the massive volatility in the market surrounding it.
which is also, I mean, it's driven by a lot, it seems like a lot of different forces that are at play here,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
One of them that really jumps out is scarcity, right? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but there are a limited number of coins that can be mined or can be owned, right?
Well, yes. So, and that's actually really driving prices currently as well. It, you know, on top of like ETFs being released and more interest and, you know, the demand side increasing, we're expecting supply side to half in April. So in Bitcoin, there's various points called the halvening is how they re refer to it. We're at various points in Bitcoin's history. The amount of energy it takes to solve these equations, or actually, it's not the amount of energy, it's basically the reward you get for solving the equation halves. So at first, you know, I solve the equation, I get one Bitcoin. And then a halvening happened, and now I only got half a Bitcoin. And then a halvening happened again, and now I only get a quarter of a Bitcoin. And so we are coming up on one of those great halvenings in April. It's expected to happen because it's based on how many Bitcoin are solved, how many equations are solved. Once we get a certain number solved, the halvening takes place. And it's expected at the rate that we're going, it's going to happen sometime in April. And after that, basically, you're getting half the reward for the same amount of work. And so that is going to increase scarcity, and people are buying up Bitcoin in expectation of that while the supply is about to be cut in half, demand is only going up. Therefore, prices should go up as well.
The scarcity principle, right? It also seems, I mean, the last time that this thing went up, I feel like there were red sirens all around because you had all of these celebrities rushing to the forefront. And I mean, I've never seen a celebrity come to the forefront and be like, you know, these corporate bonds are the stuff. Like, you got to get in on this right now. I mean, there are spokespeople out there, but the alarming number of big, high-profile people coming to the forefront and saying, like, crypto's where it's at, crypto's where it's at. Only to learn on the opposite end that crypto historically has had winters, right? They call them like
Yeah.
winter periods, like where
Winter periods. Yep.
they lose a ton of value and they stay down there until the next big increase. So I guess it's just a matter of knowing that's how it behaves, but I still get stuck on what is that, right? So it's not, I think part of the issue here is that when you talk to clients about it's not tangible, right? It's this thing that exists up in the cloud and on the ledger, and I've heard people describe it as a currency, right? They'll use currency just like you did. We're going to describe this by comparing it to currency, right? Because it does store value. Okay. But I can't buy goods and services widely at this point with it the same way that I would with dollars in my checking account or whatever currency, wherever I am in the globe, right? But then I hear the other side of it. Well, it's like, well, it's not quite a currency yet, but it's going there. For now, it's an asset, right? It's an asset just like you'd have a stock. It's an investment. It's an investment vehicle. And then you look at that more closely and you're like, well, what's the characteristic of that investment vehicle? Well, it's kind of speculative and it's volatile, right? So within that context, I don't know. That it just I've heard even the most informed people in the space talk about it, and it feels really circular. It's like, Well, it's a currency, but not quite yet. So it's an asset. But in terms of the assets, it's volatile, but you're going to want to get in on it now because we don't know where it's going. But eventually, it's going to be a currency. And you go in this big loop.
Well, I'm
And
sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but it just leaves it. You know, I like to think that in our shop, like we as a collective at Biff, like we have good grasps of this financial stuff, right? And it leaves me, even with that backdrop, it leaves me kind of confused still. I'm like, is it a to one day I'm gonna grow up and be a currency? Am I a currency? Am I an asset? What type of asset? I mean, you said commodity, right? So it's more of a commodity type of thing in your
Well,
portfolio.
I think currency in its purest state is also a commodity. Like I think back, I think a good way to think about it is to go back to the beginning of currency in general. So, we go back to the Paleolithic period or whatever. I'm going to show how weak my history is as far as time frames go right here. But I breed chickens, you grow corn, and I want some corn. So I come to you and I go, "Hey, Adam, I got some chickens. You want to trade some of your corn for my chickens?" And you say, "You know what? I don't. I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat chickens. I don't need your chickens." We cannot have that trade there because you have something I want. I have resources, but they're not resources you particularly want. No transaction happens. And so our ancestors, a way they solved that is, well, they agreed upon a kind of commonly acceptable resource that was, very, very marketable, very liquid. And that was typically, precious metals, gold and silver. So now it's like, okay, I take my chickens, I sell my chickens to someone else, they give me gold, and now I come to you and I say, "Okay, hey Adam, take some of my golds, I'll take some of your corn." And so that gold has come in and it's been the intermediary that has allowed us to make that transaction. And now, because of disagreements, people shaving off the gold, people putting lead and then wrapping lead in gold and things like that, people became distrustful of gold because, people would do counterfeiting, or not even counterfeiting at this stage, but they would be dishonest in order to make the gold stretch a little bit. And so governments came into play into place, and they would take that gold and they would mint that gold into gold coins. And now they have a currency that it's not so much, yes, the value is backed by the physical gold in there, but it's more derived from the promise that that gold is worth one gold piece because it's stamped by the government saying, "This is one of our official coins. It is going to have a certain amount of gold in it that we back as a government promise." And you've seen throughout history that when governments stopped doing that, the Romans, they started shaving the coins. That's why if you look at quarters or any sort of coin these days, they have that ridge on it. And that's harkening back to the old days where people would actually shave around the edges to take
I
some of
never
the
knew
silver off of it.
that.
So that's why, if you didn't know why coins have ridges, is to show that it hasn't been shaved, because that causes people to lose trust in the currency. And so that is how, currency evolved. And now we went to paper money because it was more convenient, but it's still, we have all those security features on paper money because it's all about trust. And then, it evolved to where we are today. That is where I kind of put Bitcoin on that evolutionary scale, is like, yes, it was an asset at first. Now it is developing into that currency. And it's like I said, it's all about trust. And the ledger is the trust. And people trust Bitcoin because the way the system is designed, the only possible way you could counterfeit a Bitcoin is by having 51% of all computers tied to the market. And it's impossible, it's not possible for someone to have 51% of all computers tied into the Bitcoin ledger. That's millions and millions of computers. It's just not physically possible for someone to do that. And so it makes it very secure. And so people have a lot of trust in Bitcoin. So when we talk about Bitcoin as a currency, I think about talking about it as a store of trust. And because of that, it's very, very secure. And while the supply and demand could cause the price volatility to fluctuate up and down, people's trust in Bitcoin still stays constant. So when the winters happen and Bitcoin goes down, it never goes down to previous levels. It maybe it goes up, you know, maybe 300% in a boom, and then it crashes back down, but it maybe it only crashes down to 200% of the value, and then it stays there. And then it goes up 300%, and then maybe it crashes back down to 200%, but it's still on this constant trajectory upwards, just with very long, sometimes years at a time. I think the last winter was probably like 5 years, or 4 years at this point, of basically a plateau value where it just doesn't change very much. And now we're starting to see it start going up at that peak. So yes, if you buy into Bitcoin, you have a great chance of losing a lot of money. But and I've lost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on Bitcoin because it went way, way, way up. And I mean, I was making lots of money when it went way, way, way up, but then it crashed back down and I lost tens of thousands of dollars. If I had sold right there, you know, I would be seeing red and I would be pretty upset. But I held on to it, and now my positions are way profitable again because I actually looked it up. It's the low point was in about October, when it was about $25,000 a Bitcoin. As of today, it's $65,000 a Bitcoin. So just in the last few months, it's almost, you know, tripled in value. So you know, because of that, if you hold on to it and hold on to it through these winters, it does tend to rebound, and that is what we have historically seen happen with Bitcoin.
It's all right. I'm going to treat this the same way I would treat a stock for a company that I believe in, right? It's like it's buy, hold over the long run. This is going to work out. I'm prepared. I can weather any dips that will happen because they will, just like in the markets. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when things change and the markets react as a result. What I fear is when, like, my wife starts talking about these things. You start hearing more stories about it, and there are people who look at it as, all right, this is my ticket, right? I'm gonna unload everything I got and put it into this asset because it's going up, baby, and I wanna be along for the ride. I'll cash out. I'll take my gardening business. I'll close up shop. I won't let anyone know about it, and I'll go get myself like a yacht. You know, those stories are floating around out there. But the flip side of that is you time it wrong, and there are truly, I mean, just like you said, you lost in, you know, realized losses within your account. There are people out there who I've seen and actually worked with because they got in such a horrible place because they made wrong decisions. They were terribly overallocated to Bitcoin and they sold at the wrong possible moment and now literally have nothing in their investment accounts and are starting from scratch because they just got in at the wrong time. They made the wrong move. And but you hear it on both ways. I mean, it's
It's
really.
not for the weak of heart by any means.
But I think that's some of the hype out there, right? Like, it's now, like we talked about at the top, it's now going to be in ETFs that, because a lot of the broker dealers are supporting this, it's going to be a far more widespread in terms of people's exposure to this, potentially, if they are seeking that. Like, it's going to be out there. You're not going to have those separate wallets for it, right? You could just have this in your brokerage account. And I just wonder, like, is the education on it clear enough? And are people really aware of the fact that you're buying into something that is highly volatile and, like, treat it as such? Yes, if there are gains here to be had over the decade, you want to be a part of that. But when I hear really informed people being like, every retiree that I work with has Bitcoin allocation because this is their last time to buy in. I'm like, eh, like that makes me a little uneasy. Like, that every retiree needs to step in and have a portion of their portfolio, like that. And again, I'm fully admitting I'm underinformed here, but in terms of, like, just planning awareness, right? Planning instinct. That makes me hesitate when I hear I must put this asset in all my retirees' accounts that I work with, it almost feels like, well, then are you acting as a fiduciary? Because if that person across the table from you really knew what they were getting into, would they be comfortable heading into retirement with a segment of their portfolio that can be wildly up and then wildly down? And I guess that just comes down to the person. So
Yeah,
I
well,
don't know,
so
Jerry. Very
couple
confused still.
so yeah, couple points in there. First of all, as far as like putting every retiree, I definitely don't agree with that. I think cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, it's some of the most volatile positions that you could open in a client's account. You know, I've traded options for years. I've traded
Yeah.
futures contracts. I have a very high risk tolerance, I would say. I can stomach some risk. I would say, you know, Bitcoin makes options trading look like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It's like a whole other level of volatility. So yeah, I think that always comes down to just suitability with your clients. You know, if you would purchased, you know, futures or options or do you know, complex multi-leg options trades in a client's account, then yeah, Bitcoin could probably be right for them. If you're talking about a pensioner who's on a limited income and is you know, relying on this money to see them through the retirement, no, I probably would not put them in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I don't think that would probably be a great idea for them, or even any of the others like Ethereum, which we haven't touched on as much, but Ethereum follows a pretty similar trajectory as Bitcoin as well. But so yeah, suitability always going to come to the forefront. You got to do your fiduciary duty. You have to make sure that it's going to be right for the client. And I think we're going to look back on this time frame with that in the same way that we look back on kind of like annuities in the 90s, and how people were just, you know, shoving people into annuity contracts that really wasn't suitable for them, and we look back at them with a lot of chagrin. I think in the future we're going to have a similar you know, hindsight to this point in time surrounding putting clients into cryptocurrency as we did with annuities back then. But with that, the other point as far as the ETS being introduced, I actually think that's going to mellow out the volatility quite a deal, because it happens with any sort of asset or commodity or anything like that. The larger amount of people you have interacting with that commodity, the more the smaller the margin gets, you get a more efficient market, you have more buyers, you have more sellers, and it makes it harder for these really dramatic swings to happen. You know, you see these massive swings in Bitcoin's history, and the smaller the user base, the greater those swings were, just because there's less people. When people have a panic and they want to sell, there are not those buyers readily available, and so the price absolutely tanks. But if you have a much larger user base, which these ETFs are going to bring into these cryptocurrencies, well, now when a segment of people start panicking and they try and they want to sell, there are more buyers available that can kind of pick up the falling price and prevent it from going into a straight free fall. Because when you have, you know, if you only have a very small number of investors, and one guy just he needs to buy a house, or you know, he's reallocated his portfolio without even realizing it, he can trigger a massive sell-off because he's just trying to cash out, not because he doesn't have faith in the asset anymore, but he just needs access to that liquidity to put it somewhere else. And someone else sees that and they freak out, like, oh, maybe he knows something that I don't know, I'm gonna sell my stuff too. And now you just have this domino effect of people having this massive sell-off. But if you have a much larger pool of investors, you know, that one person selling it off turns into a small blip on the radar. It's not as big a deal, and there's another buyer there ready to step in and pick up and purchase those cryptocurrency coins. And so it avoids the panic. You need a much higher density of people selling off to trigger these mass panic sales.
And that makes sense that you'll have a broader pool. And I mean, it seems that that's really what would need to happen, right? For there to be widely adopted. I mean, and I think what's difficult about that is that it's not just a country or a region like the euro, right? It's global. And I just wonder what even full adoption or near full adoption looks like with something like that, where it's usable and wherever you go, there's a way that you can access that. And I suppose you could say, well, you can just trade the crypto in for whatever the local currency is, right? And you can use the local
And
currency.
there's an ATM down the street from me. I can go.
Yes.
I can like type in my wallet and then it'll shoot out US dollars and it'll subtract that Bitcoin from my account. Like those things are popping up all over the
They
world.
are. Yeah, there's a absolutely shady little gas station bodega on the Hartford West Hartford line that has the lone Bitcoin transfer station, if you want to call it. But yeah, you can the Bitcoin exchange. So
But that's
yeah,
the
I'm it's surprising. I mean, it's surprising to see that starting to become a feature, much like an ATM was, right? I mean, there was a time where you had to do the banking in the actual bank or the drive-through thing with the tube.
right. It reminds me going back to historical allegories of kind of like the early adoption of credit cards. You know, the first credit card I think was like some restaurant in New York issued it as like for their like favorite customers, and then it just like kind of exploded from there, and then. You know, people like, oh, do you accept Visa? Do you accept, you know, now you don't even ask. You know, I remember when I was a kid, you would go to a store and you would have to ask the store which credit cards they accept. Now it's like no one even asks. It's just like, oh, yeah, here's my card. Like maybe Amex, people won't accept Amex because of their high fees or whatever. But for the most part, you just hand them your credit card and you're on your way because there's such widespread adoption. And I think that's the trajectory cryptocurrency is going to be on, that eventually it's just going to be. You know, you're going to have a little Bitcoin card in your wallet that you can use to pay for it at the supermarket or at a restaurant or something like that, and you won't even think twice about it anymore.
Well, one area where we have seen wide adoption of it is on the old form 1040, because digital assets and cryptocurrency, and it has a simple yes no check the box requirement that you must check each time you file your taxes annually, or else it'll get kicked back and not be approved. And the language is it's a catch-all, really. And it says, you know, in the prior year, have you sold, traded, exchanged, transferred any digital currency? I mean, it's that wide of a definition. And you just have to check off the appropriate box. And really what a lot of people in the tax domain think that is, and it's proving out, is it's meant to be a catch-all while the rules and regulations around digital assets start to funnel through the IRS's notices, and there's some clear guidance on how to handle and process all this stuff over time. So they keep it very simple and very broad, but I think it's you will definitely expect some more specific guidance on the many things that you can do that are different. I mean, this is a very different way of even the storage, right? The storage is far different. This whole idea of a ledger with that carries all of the bitcoins, the way it's mined. I mean, this is all new stuff, and it's taken the IRS some time to get caught up to speed.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten into like proof of stake or anything like that because Ethereum, unlike Bitcoin, you can't mine Ethereum anymore. You know, Ethereum's done. There's no more mining of it. But what you can do is you can do proof of stake where you basically can put your Ethereum coins into escrow, and that is your kind of ticket to participate in the ledger system. And instead of receiving Ethereum that gets newly generated, you receive fees from the people making the transfer. So that's a whole other thing that we won't get into because that's a rabbit hole in itself. But you know, those fees are probably going to end up being taxed in some way. And I'm interested to see how they handle cost basis because, like I said, I mined Ethereum, so I have Ethereum coins that theoretically have a zero cost basis because they just appeared in my account. You know, I got them through mining, so they have I didn't purchase them, so they have a zero cost basis. But it's not like that cost me $0. You know, the equipment needed to mine it cost money. The electricity to run that equipment cost money. So how do I really figure out what my cost basis in that Ethereum
Yeah,
coin
it's a
really
very good
is?
question
Or does the government just
because,
say it's like, we don't care, it's zero, deal with
well, yeah, well, that, I mean,
it?
that would be more beneficial from a tax revenue side, right? To
Yeah.
treat it all as zero basis because then the gains are all going to be taxable.
Right.
But you, I mean, let's just use a different analogy outside of cryptocurrency. If you buy a home, right? You can that real property is an asset. And what happens is you have your purchase price, but then any fees that you're going to pay, you know, the title insurance, some of the attorney fees, like that, all of that gets wrapped into an addition on top of your basis. So if we look to cryptocurrency, I mean, I think being consistent with that treatment is that there are fees that you paid to do that. I just wonder how that would be calculated even. I mean, would it be,
Or like,
I
how
ran
are
this
you? Am I gonna pull
computer for
my electricity bill from like 2016? Like,
and
how am I even gonna
said
figure that out?
it took this many, you know, watts of power over this amount of time to mine this,
Yep.
and this represented, you know, X portion of my internet access. I mean, I don't know how there probably has to be some sort of like simplified formula that you can put in place that's just like, this is just going to serve as your basis.
Right. And I was just doing it as a hobby. Like, I was just doing it on my personal PC as a hobby. There are people who had like whole server farms set up where they had, hundreds of computers, and like those are the people that are really going to be interested to see how the cost basis allocation is going to work for them, because they have, millions of dollars invested into startup costs, to get these things working.
So with even with the taxes, right? I just feel like as we get more familiar with this, just the nature of cryptocurrency going up and down, you know, 3 year period, year and a half period, it could lead to some ugly tax stuff. If you're trying to do the right thing, if you buy something and you see you're in one of those declines and you don't want to sit through it, you could be crushed tax-wise, right? Because it's going to be treated as one of your stocks. It's a capital asset, right? You hold it for fewer than 12 months. That's going to be all short-term cap gains if you have gains left. So that's something to consider too. And I wonder, like, is there awareness in crypto communities about how that works? Because I remember at the last downturn, there seemed to be a lot of people who were really surprised and saying, "Well, I thought this was a capital asset. You know, why would I be taxed at my marginal rates?" And not thinking, "Oh, it's a short-term capital gain rate, which is your highest marginal rate, right?"
Yeah,
So
that, and also is like, for the longest time, I would say for the vast majority of cryptocurrencies, kind of just wasn't taxed at all. It just wasn't even on the government's radar. There was all sorts of like money laundering involved, where people
Sure.
would exchange taxable assets for cryptocurrency and then sell the cryptocurrency because then they wouldn't be taxed on it, and all sorts of shell games people were playing. Involving even, like, I think we talked about it on our collectibles issue episode, that people were, using magic cards for tax evasion and cryptocurrency and things like that. So yeah, I think the community is also just starting to kind of realize what all this means from a tax implication, as the IRS and as the government kind of becomes aware of it as well. So I think it's going to be kind of a learning process for everyone involved, at the same time.
There, you know, with the EA designation, right? There are people that think, oh, like you're enforcing the IRS rules on people, and it's not true. You can represent people, and when you are working with someone, you're obligated to tell them what the repercussions would be if they have a certain taxable event, right? I happened to hear something through another person who was connected to this person who took a he had money fronted from his credit card to buy in to one of the coins that they had a sense was going to go berserk, and made a absolute killing and cashed out at the right moment. and you hear so many stories, like the rags to riches, right?
Yep.
And this person told the person I know that I have zero intention of reporting anything to the government. They don't need to know about it. Which comes back to that check in the box,
Right.
because if there was a transfer, right, it's gonna it, there, we're now at a place where that's gonna be documented somewhere,
Yep.
and it's really just a matter of time before there's honestly some sort of auditing system like you'd see with a lot of the 1040s, where it's like, well, this was reported to us and this is visible to the IRS. And it needs to be reflected in your return. And for
Yeah.
now, it's that check in the box, and
It
then your Schedule D, right? You could do all this transactions on Schedule D, but
it's interesting, and I keep going comparing it to other assets, which is funny. I know that drives you crazy, but it reminds me of
it's
kind of
okay.
like gold and silver. You know,
Yeah.
I could buy gold and silver through Fidelity, through a brokerage, I could do that, and then Fidelity is going to generate a tax form for me at the end of the year.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Or I could go to a gold and silver convention or a coin collection convention or one of those things, and I could just do a or I could even just go to a pawn shop and
Yeah.
I could do a little back alley deal where I sell them some gold, and that's like, well, they don't know, there's no tax form generated on this transaction.
Yeah.
If I
Yeah.
don't tell them, how are they ever going to know? Bitcoin and cryptocurrency can be the same thing. It's like, yes, I can trade cryptocurrency on Robinhood and Fidelity and Vanguard, all these different brokerage firms. And they're going to generate a tax form and they're going to send that to the IRS. But I could also go to the sketchy gas station bodega by Adam's house, and I could trade, some Bitcoin for some Doritos and some Mountain Dew. And how would the IRS ever know about that? How are they going to? Or I could, do a direct transfer from, like, yeah. So it's just, the thing is, though, is one of the greatest strengths of Bitcoin is the ledger system. If the IRS could really kind of get their hands on it and do it, is every transaction is trackable. So
Yeah.
it's almost like it's even harder to hide it once the IRS actually starts caring. Once they start paying attention, they can just look at the ledger system and they could see, it's like, hey, you received 500 Bitcoin and you sold 500 Bitcoin. We know exactly how much you made because this is the prices at these dates,
Yeah.
and we see these transactions right here. So that's a big misconception with Bitcoin, is people think that you buy Bitcoin to hide from the government. You're not hiding from anyone. Everything's public information. There's no hiding with it. That's the biggest strength of it, is that everything's public, so you can't counterfeit it.
So you could feasibly see in the nearer future some sort of requirement that if it's bought, sold within the US, right?
Yep.
Or possibly even outside the US,
Yeah.
that some sort of tax form be generated for US residents or US citizens living abroad or whatever the case may be. But if there's access to that ledger, I don't think it's a far step for some laws and regulations to come down the pike that say, all right, well, you got to kick out a tax form. Just like you do now with some of your third party platforms, right?
Yeah.
PayPal, Square.
Yep.
You go over a certain threshold with that, it is kicking out a 1099 form, right?
Well, you say kick out a tax form. It's like, so the IRS has access to that. They can see that, but there's no one for the IRS to go, it's like, hey, nebulous Bitcoin ledger system, kick out a tax form. Like,
Sure.
there's no organization there. It's just a community. So it's I think it might actually even be a impetus for us to get some tax reform law coming into play, where the IRS is going to initiate and say, hey, this is what we have.
Yeah.
Do you disagree with it? If not, this is what we're taxing you on. And that
Sure.
would be nice, because if they extended that to the rest of the tax code, we wouldn't have to worry about tax forms at all. The IRS would just get all this information and you would just check a box like, do you agree? Yes or no? Would you like to dispute? And then your taxes are done. That
Well, that's the funny thing, right?
would be
It's
nice. That
it...
would be funny if Bitcoin is the impetus to cause all of that to happen.
And that's funny because that's the game you play each year with your taxes, which is we at the IRS, we know the deal, right?
Yep.
But you tell us what happened, and
Right.
then we'll let you know if we agree or not. Now, to that point, their information sometimes, I mean, I've seen forms for withdrawals of Roth IRA basis, right? That the I that the platform and the custodian will mark as younger than 59 and a half. When the truth is they've just taken out, yes, this person is under 59 and a half, but they've taken out basis.
That
So it's
happened to me
not a
last
taxable
year.
thing.
That happened to me
Yeah.
last year. I hit the wrong drop down on a money transfer, and I accidentally withdrew from my Roth. Realized my mistake same day. Put that money back in, and it was a 60-day rollover. I'm like, I'm not gonna use it this year, so I don't care. So I just didn't expecting nothing of that. Then I go to do my taxes, and I get a thing saying I have an early under 59 and a half withdrawal, and I'm like, no, and I had to
No.
fight that whole thing.
It's crazy. Yeah, so they do have the data, right? And I mean, this also happens with your standard W-2 forms. There are sometimes when those get submitted and there's something that needs to be adjusted on them with your 1099 forms. That they do rely on the integrity of the data that goes to them. And often your tax preparer, along with the taxpayer, are gonna verify that. And also within the tax code, know, all right, we can lower this and it's legal, right? This is you are entitled to this type of deduction if you're someone like you are. So yeah, it's just really fascinating to be seeing this stuff happen slowly in real time. And by no means, Jerry, am I knocking you or, you know, passing judgment. I mean,
Oh, believe
I
me,
just
I
have
know
my
it's very risky. It's a roll of the dice.
somewhat, you know, you're clearly more of a risk taker on that front than I am by a long stretch. I think it's also just the your experiences around it too kind of inform your opinion of it and how comfortable you feel. And I mean, you know, I won't recount all the stories, but it seems like there's always a story looming around the corner. And it often, you know, it's like that old what's newsworthy, right? Dramatic. You know, people going completely broke, people becoming billionaires, right? It's one of these big dramatic events that happen, and you start hearing that in your circles with like, oh, so and so invested in Bitcoin at the right time. They got out at the right time, and you know, they live in the mansion now.
Yeah,
Or
I
you
think
hear
if
people like the people I was sitting, you know, across a Zoom from, tell me about your investment accounts. Well, yeah, about that. We don't see eye to eye on investment risk, and my spouse went and bought all this. Took all of our investments, put them into digital assets, and the thing crashed, and we didn't know what to do, so we sold all of it to try to save a little bit.
And the thing is, if they probably held
Yeah.
that they had would probably triple in value. Well, it's tripled in value since October. But yeah, I definitely think if you're going to buy into Bitcoin, the time to do it is during one of those winters. And like me, if I had sold out, I would have realized tens of thousands of dollars of losses. But because I had that high risk tolerance, I just sat on it. And I saw that big fat red number in my portfolio, for years at this point. I saw years of that big fat. It was my biggest loser I've ever had in my entire life. And now, since October, it's tripled in value. Now it's my biggest gainer in my portfolio. So
Yeah.
if you're going to do it, you have to have an ironclad, risk tolerance. You can't sell out when things go down like that, because yeah, you are going to have those really negative experiences. To close us out, Adam, because this episode's getting a little long, we
Yeah.
have not yet seen Bitcoin on the CFP exam. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we've seen any Bitcoin questions, but I do think it's only a matter of time until we do. So, how do we think the CFP board is going to test on Bitcoin when they eventually do start testing on it?
Oh wow, that's a really good question. I think the first place to go is going to be your portfolio design type of questions or suitability, honestly. Just client suitability stuff, being that when you hold the marks, you're to act in your client's best interest. And it almost feels like it queues up nicely for one of those, the planner and the client aren't seeing eye to eye And maybe are bringing their biases into this.
Yeah, client wants to put 100% of their portfolio into
yes. And
Bitcoin.
then how do you apply some of those standards, right? So you have a duty to follow the instructions. Is that legal? Yep. Is it reasonable? And it's that gray area, right, that I think I could see him tested on. How about you? What are a couple spots you think it could be tested?
Yeah, my first kind of thing that I would jump to is the asset allocation type questions. Like, you have a client, they're X number of years old, their risk tolerance is Y. Choose the best portfolio for them. And it's like A, 50% stocks, 30% bonds, 20% cash. And then I think we'll see it's like B, 20% cryptocurrency, 50% stock, 30% bonds. And I could definitely see those answer options start popping up. That's kind of what I jump to. I think you're right, the suitability as far as client disagreements, how do you handle the situation? And then I do think once the tax code catches up to reality, I think we are going to start seeing calculating taxes on cryptocurrency once that gets solidified.
Yeah, I could see that too. I'm just quickly scanning the learning objectives for the CFP board, and yeah, I mean it can fall under characteristics, uses, taxation of investment vehicles. It's definitely got a home there. Asset allocation, portfolio diversification. That's another one. Portfolio development and analysis. That's another one. Investment strategies. And then, oh, there we go. It is mentioned
Oh, they are mentioning it.
in,
Okay.
yeah, in standard D35, alternative investments and liquidity risk. And it reads, define and describe what qualifies as an alternative investment, for example, cryptocurrency, precious metals, etc. So
Okay.
it's
So it's already
there.
it's creeping in there.
It's creeping in there. But we have yet to hear anything clear on the angle.
I know. I'm going to be interested to hear the first student who says, "Hey, I got a cryptocurrency question
Yeah,
on the
right?
exam."
Yeah, absolutely.
I can imagine some nightmare tax questions like your client transferred Bitcoin from their cold storage ledger to the exchange and then traveled to Europe on vacation where they bought. How is it taxed?
You discover in looking under the hood of your new client's portfolio that they are allocated 100% to Bitcoin. What would the planner do next? And you'll, I mean, terminate the engagement,
Sell the
talk to them.
portfolio without speaking to the
You could easily see it go in that direction too. But that's a glimpse of things to come too, because they changed those learning objectives. What is it? Is it every 4 to 5 years after they conduct their survey of practitioners to get a sense of what they're doing in their practices? And there you have it. It's a sub bullet point underneath a learning objective in investment planning.
Well, there we have it. That was a little fun episode for you guys, a little glimpse of CFP future. Hope you guys enjoyed. Hopefully you learned a little bit. And like I said, by no means are Adam and I experts, but we just kind of wanted to weigh in with our own kind of personal opinions about this very dynamic topic in the industry.
Absolutely. And just looking at some of the resources out there is no shortage of cryptocurrency podcasts. I learned that this week,
Oh, yeah.
that so many that you can't even figure out where to start. And that's another one thing too. I was looking for a crypto 101 experience, and there's a podcast out there. There are actually two podcasts, the Crypto 101 podcast and Crypto 101, and they both seem, more complex. But I know if I did some digging, I could probably find some good, let's take this from the ground floor up, type of experiences. So just like anything else, there's some good resources out there if you're learning, wanting
Oh,
to learn more. And
it's a deep topic because I've been dealing with cryptocurrency for years, and there are still tons about it that I do not understand and I do not, fully grasp. So, yeah, you can really go down the rabbit hole with this topic.
so clearly before I share even more hot takes, I could do a little bit of research here. I could listen to some podcasts. Most of all, to serve clients well, I think, and to understand how that asset could interact with their portfolios, how they could benefit, where there might be risks. I think that's important for all planners to know, and especially in our program. I mean, if this is one of the CFP learning objectives, it's just a matter of time before we start seeing it tested more frequently.
For sure. For sure.
Good
Well,
times here, Jerry. Enjoyed it.
yeah, good stuff. That about does it for this week. If you'd like some more great Biff Bytes content, make sure you check out our website over at biffbytes.com. And if you are thinking of sitting for the July CFP exam, we are taking signups for our Biff Review. So if you like the podcast, you like our kind of teaching style, and you want some more of it with some more in-depth review on all the CFP topics, make sure you head over to the Boston Institute of Finance.com and sign up for the Biff Review.
All right. And one last thing too. If you have topics you'd like the Biff guys to discuss, we remind the listeners of this periodically. Send them on in because Jerry and I talk often about different episode ideas and Mike does as well. And it'd be great to hear from you first of all, but it'd be fun to put some new episodes together just based on what your interests are. But yeah, definitely join the Biff Review for July. It's always exciting to be at this point and know that people are putting in the work in the program and the program's working. So come on board. We got some good stuff here.
Study on, everyone.